Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, the Senate version of the healthcare bill is available for the public to view after a long and secretive process in the United States Senate. And the Better Care Reconciliation Act looks like the House healthcare bill, with a few exceptions. The Senate is delaying a vote on its version of the bill to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act when it became clear that a vote before the July 4th recess would come up short of the necessary votes. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell called for a delay. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office released a rather scathing score of the Senate Republican health bill. The CBO says that the Senate health bill will lead to 22 million Americans losing health coverage.
Well, let's just say that would be a devastating blow to the millions of Americans who receive care through Medicaid, whether it's the disabled, dual-eligible seniors, other vulnerable populations, including, Mark, and I think people don't realize this, 40% of the nation's children. And that could seriously undermine access to quality care for so many people and have a profound influence on health outcomes.
Well, the Senate bill has been described as a shift of wealth from the poor to the rich, offering significant tax cuts to the insurance industry as well as to other stakeholders, including a $50,000 tax cut to Americans making $1 million or more.
And the nonpartisan CBO scored the House bill very negatively, saying it would lead to the loss of health coverage for at least 23 million Americans and would raise costs significantly for health consumers, with a particular hit on older, sicker Americans while covering less. But no matter what the score, you just have to see the reality. It's bound to cause harm to many of the nation's most vulnerable residents, including children.
And that brings us to today's guest, Margaret. Every few years, we like to check in with Carolyn Miles, CEO of Save the Children, a global nonprofit agency dedicated to improving the health and well-being of 150 million children in over 120 countries around the world. They've just released a new report on the status of children worldwide, and the conclusion is that a quarter of the world's children are being denied a childhood.
And Save the Children has been on the front lines attempting to address many of these issues for so many years. So we look forward to catching up with Carolyn Miles and hearing about their important work in this new report.
And Lori Robertson stops by. She's the managing editor of factcheck.org, who looks at misstatements about health policy in the public domain. But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter, because we love to hear from you. We'll get to our interview with Carolyn Miles in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. They're going for the delay. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell had been gunning for an early vote on the GOP-controlled Senate's health care bill and had wanted to vote on that bill before the start of the July 4th recess. But there is significant opposition. Senate Republicans released their secretly crafted answer to the House's American Health Care Act, and for all intents and purposes, the Senate version is quite similar. Elimination of Medicaid expansion, elimination of the individual mandate to require Americans to buy insurance, and a chance for states to apply for waivers that will allow them to cover less and charge more for those with pre-existing conditions. According to the CBO, 22 million Americans would end coverage or lose it within 10 years, bringing the nation's uninsured rate back to about 48 million Americans total. Insurance companies could enact payout limits and lifetime caps on coverage, which could devastate those dealing with catastrophic illness or complex chronic diseases. Insurance companies would be allowed to charge older, sicker Americans higher premiums, five times as much. The Senate needs 51 votes to pass the bill, which could get done with 50 Republican senators and Vice President Mike Pence lending a deciding vote. But the number of Republican senators who say they won't vote for the measure grew to at least five, including senators like Susan Collins of Maine, who says the bill would harm the one in five residents of her state who rely on Medicaid, and senators such as Rand Paul, who called the bill Obamacare Lite, saying it leaves too many restrictions in place. Meanwhile, a bipartisan coalition of the nation's governors are expressing extreme displeasure with the bill, which they say will harm state governments significantly. Ohio Republican Governor John Kasich is leading the coalition, which includes Nevada's Republican Governor Sandoval and Colorado Governor Hickenlooper, a Democrat, all pointing returning to Medicaid cutbacks, specifically as a threat to not just the health of their residents, but to the stability of the health industry and state budgets as well. And across the country, numerous industry organizations are lambasting the Republican health legislation. The American Medical Association released a vociferous opposition in a letter to the Senate, saying it violates the gold standard for the health profession to first do no harm, urging GOP senators to vote against the bill. Senators are planning on holding town halls at various locations around the country during the July 4th recess, including Louisiana Senator Bill Cassidy, a Republican and physician who is uncertain he can support a bill that harms so many that rely on the safety net. A year after it was first launched, participants of former President Obama's Cancer Moonshot Initiative, led by former Vice President Joe Biden, met again in Washington to discuss their goals for curing cancer. The Cancer Moonshot One Year Later Summit renewed commitment to collaborating on better data sharing for faster cures, but also committing to keep up pressure on the current powers that be in Washington in the wake of significant cuts to science and research budgets under President Trump. And wave of the future for infertility. Scientists have used a 3D printer to create a mouse ovary capable of producing healthy offspring. In the mice, the result was a structure of about the size of a pea, recreating the environment inside natural ovaries. Next, researchers placed real tissue from mouse ovaries, known as follicles, into the 3D printed ovary scaffolds. Follicles contain immature eggs and cells that secrete hormones needed for reproduction. The researchers transplanted the devices into sterilized mice. Blood vessels attached themselves to partially artificial ovaries, which then began to function. Researchers hope to create replacement human ovaries someday in the future. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Carolyn Miles, President and CEO of Save the Children, which serves the health and well-being of 143 million children in the U.S. and in 120 countries around the world. Prior to becoming CEO, Ms. Miles served as Chief Operating Officer at Save the Children. She spent her earlier career working as an entrepreneur, as well as for American Express in Hong Kong, where her attention shifted to improving childhood welfare, with a focus in on improved nutrition, access to healthcare, and education. Ms. Miles has served on numerous boards, including the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, where she received her MBA. She was named one of 50 of the world's greatest leaders by Fortune magazine. Carolyn, welcome back to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thanks so much, Mark and Margaret. It's great to be back with you both.
Yeah, and it's been a few years since we caught up on the refugee crisis. And at that point, you were telling us about just the incredible dislocation that was happening to millions of children around the world. And really, it does not seem like it has gotten better. And at last check, a record number, more than 65 million people in the world are now living in, as displaced refugees around the world, and half of them are children. But I'm wondering if you could bring our listeners up to date on the status of the refugee crisis and its continued impact on children's lives.
Well, sure. I wish I could say that things have gotten a lot better since the last time we spoke, but as you said, they haven't. And 22.5 million people are refugees, and that includes 11 million children. So there are massive numbers of children that have been affected, and Save the Children's been working on this crisis really for 6 years now. But I also think it's really important to put a face to this crisis. I've been spending much of my time traveling to visit the refugee crisis again. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I met a young girl in Lebanon, for example, who was in school for the first time in 3 years since she had last been in her hometown of Aleppo. So understanding what these families have been through and what the hardship that these families mm-hmm. have been through is really important. And I think one of the things that we're finding is that the mental trauma is really starting to show up mm-hmm. in kids. Many more instances of self-harm, in bedwetting, in nightmares, and those kinds of things. And that's really showing up now in a bigger way. And if you think about it, it's understandable because mm-hmm. these kids have been under stress for so long. So we continue to try to provide those safe places for children, the outlets for them to have some normalcy, that's super important, I think, for these children.
Well, Carolyn, Save the Children has just released an in-depth analysis of the plight of the world's children, the inaugural End of Childhood Report. That's a chilling title right there. 700 million children, roughly a quarter of the world's child population, really being denied the experience of being a child, of childhood. Really, these children are found everywhere being impacted by a variety of challenges, from war to displacement, poverty, and lack of access to basic resources. Tell us what some of the most troubling impacts on childhood, on these children, are that you found, and their likely long-term effects in terms of stress and really almost a post-traumatic stress syndrome. But please share with us what you found.
Sure. Well, I think we can all relate to childhood as a time that should be, you know, a time to learn, to play. But unfortunately, this report showed us that one in four children, for them, their childhood's ending too soon. And so that's why we launched this report. It was really to raise the fact that this is happening for so many kids around the world. So we looked at actually eight what we call childhood enders, things like child mortality, so children being killed before their 18th birthday, malnutrition, which stunts children, not just physically, but it stunts their growth mentally, being out of school, so having an end to their education, child labor, really a child going to work at a very young age, child marriage, which we know for girls particularly is a huge ender of childhood, being a victim of extreme violence, and I was in Latin America where I saw this earlier this year, and then forced displacement by conflict, so being a refugee or being displaced inside your country. Those are the things that really we believe end childhood, and we looked across 172 countries, and we ranked countries in terms of their ranking on those eight indicators. But one of the things that we found is that when we examined these childhood enders, refugees and the inability to live in your home is one of those enders, and that really is driving kids out of school. It's causing early marriage, actually, for a lot of the girls. So, you know, we're still seeing things like malnutrition being huge problems. So you'll see that, you know, children are physically smaller, shorter, and lighter. But what you don't see from the physical side is what happens to kids' brains. And we know that nutrition is so critical, particularly in those early years.
You know, Carolyn, I imagine as you start to deal with so many different individuals and so many different cultures and mores, that they raise all sorts of different problems for you. Child marriage in particular, and it still seems to be culturally accepted in many societies. And one girl under 15 is forced to marry every 7 seconds around the world. And I wonder, again, if you could share with our listeners the long-term impact on childhood marriage.
Sure. And as you said, Mark, there are 40 million girls aged 15 to 19 currently who are married at those ages. So girls who are married as children, they're much more likely to drop out of school. Most of them will drop out of school. They will then usually have a child within a very short time of being married. When they're marrying at the age of 13 or 14, they will have children then at 15 or 16. And kids having kids is very dangerous, not only for the mother, but it's also quite dangerous for the baby. So you have higher rates of child deaths, prenatal issues for the mother. And then it's more likely for this whole cycle to repeat. Those children don't get an opportunity to go to school. So, you know, one of the best things to protect children is to really move that age of marriage up for girls. I was just in Greece about 2 weeks ago and visiting some of our refugee programs there, and I met a woman named Rosa. She was 20 years old. She had four children. She had her first child when she was 12. And she said, you know, certainly when she got married when she was 12, that was really the end. And we think not only is that wrong from the standpoint of just the rights of children to a childhood, but it's not a good thing for her children and for future generations.
Well, Carolyn, I want to talk about the economics of poverty and just the vital role that education plays in that. And your report says that one in six of the world's children are currently not in school. Just another staggering statistic to try and wrap our arms around. You know, I assume child labor is playing a role in this, but I wonder if you would speak to some of them. 1 in 6 children not in school is just a staggering figure.
It is a staggering figure, and I think it was one of the most surprising, when we did this research, it was one of the most surprising findings to me. One of the things that's really driving this number is the huge inequalities that we see in many of the countries, including our own. These are children from disadvantaged backgrounds or who are in disadvantaged groups. So girls is certainly one of those groups, because a lot of times boys' education is prioritized over girls. But there are also kids who live in conflict-affected communities. They live in remote communities or slums that are not even recognized as being there. So one of the underlying issues here is inequality. In sub-Saharan Africa alone, about 9 million girls will never attend school. You know, Save the Children's standpoint as a policy is not that children should never work, because frankly, sometimes that's an imperative. The family, the child has to work to support the family. But what we say is two things. One, it shouldn't be harmful labor, so it shouldn't be dangerous labor for a child. And two, that child should have an opportunity to go to school. So in my recent trip to Lebanon, we were visiting schools that Save the Children was running, informal schools that were for kids in child labor. And we were working with the employers to make sure that those kids, even if they were out early in the morning picking crops, which is what they were doing, and getting paid for it, that in the afternoon they could actually come to school.
So we're speaking today with Carolyn Miles, President and CEO of Save the Children, which serves the health and well-being of 143 million children in 120 countries around the world. And Carolyn, I think it's missed that Save the Children has a big presence here in the United States. But you report around the status of kids in 40 industrialized nations. And the numbers just did not bode well for kids in America, who rank near the bottom of the list in terms of health, well-being, and access to basic needs. And I'm wondering if you could just shine a light on the well-being of the next generation of our leaders.
Sure. Well, the U.S. ranks 36th out of the 40 industrialized nations that we looked at. And so we are between Bosnia and Russia. Again, I think this issue of inequality in the United States is getting worse and worse. One of the things we looked at, for example, is teen pregnancy rates. The adolescent birth rate in the U.S. Has gone down by more than 60%, but other countries are improving at a much faster rate. So again, when we talk about teen pregnancy, we know that this is an ender of childhood, and that these mothers are going to become adults, and then that mother loses her opportunity to finish school and starts a cycle that for her child is probably also not going to be good. We also see in terms of infant mortality that while, again, the death rates of babies under one have declined about 15% in the last 10 years, we still continue to have one of the highest infant mortality rates in industrialized countries. So, and about 23,000 babies in the U.S. died in 2015, in a year before their first birthday. So that shouldn't be in a country like the United States, and we've got to do better, and we have to look at what other countries are doing and say, let's try to match the progress that they're having, because they all are making much more progress than we are, and for things around childhood.
Well, Carolyn, Save the Children has conducted a state-by-state analysis to get a better understanding of how children are doing across the country. And, you know, we see such a range of disparities, you know, within a community, within a county, within a state, and within the country. So really important to look on all those levels. And the report looked at a variety of factors. You noted the look at adolescent birth weights and infant mortality. I know you also looked at child homicide and suicide rates and the rates of children not graduating high school on time. At the same moment in the country, we're looking, or Congress is looking at and considering making significant changes to health care in America. And some of that could greatly impact access to care for many children. I can't help but think when you talk about the reduction in teen births, the success of some of the long-acting reversible contraceptive programs around the country in different states that have put a focus on that has been pretty dramatic. And I'm sure you have a very long list of initiatives and priorities that you think really would make a difference for our children's health and that need to be thought about when we think about making major changes to healthcare. And I wondered if you'd like to share any of those priority initiatives with us that really will make a difference about improving the health of our children in this country.
Sure. Well, as you said, we wanted to dig in a little bit more, given that 36th ranking of the U.S. And when we looked deeper, you know, there are three things that I think as Save the Children, we really want to call on governments and communities and partners and healthcare professionals to take three actions. The first one is to invest more in children here in the United States and mobilize the resources that we need to address these childhood enders that we talked about, whether it's adolescent birth rates or food security or child homicide or infant mortality. You know, putting kids at the top of an agenda, children don't vote. We need to make sure that these things are addressed, and we need policymakers to invest in these issues for children. Secondly, we need to address this issue of inequality. So we have such disparity in the United States, and actually in many countries around the world, we see that disparity. So we need to look at making sure that, you know, we're not preventing some children from accessing services or denying education to children because of, you know, what part of the country they live in, or making sure that those, you know, those resources are getting to the kids who most need them. And then the third step is to make sure that that this access happens. So to kind of follow those services and make sure that those kids are actually getting the services that they need. So I think we also think it's really important that the public get engaged and that they know about these issues. So again, I would just drive people to go read the report on endofchildhood.org and really understand there is both the state-by-state analysis there as well as the country-by-country analysis. And you know, this is going to take people working together and saying this is not what we want to have in America. This is not what we want to have happen for kids all around the world, and particularly in the United States, because we're looking at significant cuts on things like Medicaid and children's health insurance programs. We need to raise our voices that these are important things for children and that we need to put the issues for children on the agenda.
Well,
because,
that's
as I said, they don't vote. So.
Well, that's a clarion call for action. And today we've been speaking with Carolyn Miles, President and CEO of Save the Children, which serves the health and well-being of 143 million children in the United States and in 120 countries around the world. You can learn more about their work and find a way to get involved yourself by going to savethechildren.org, or you can follow her on Twitter at Carolyn Save or at Save the Children. Also, go and look at the report, endofchildhood.org. Carolyn, thank you so much for the incredible work you and your colleagues do and for joining us today on Conversations on Healthcare.
Thanks so much.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Senate Republicans have now introduced their version of a replacement plan for the Affordable Care Act. Let's look at some of the ways it compares with the House plan and current law under the ACA. Both GOP bills would eliminate the requirement to have insurance or pay a tax, though there are penalties associated with not having continuous coverage. And both phase out the enhanced federal funding for the Medicaid expansion under the ACA. That allowed states to expand Medicaid eligibility to all individuals under age 65 who earn up to 138% of the federal poverty level. 31 states in the District of Columbia have opted in to the expansion. Under the ACA, the federal government now pays 95% of the cost for the expansion population, an amount that will gradually decline to 90% by 2020. Under the Senate bill, that funding would be reduced starting in 2021, and in 2024, the enhanced federal funding ends and reverts to a regular state match rate, which is an average of 57%. The House bill wouldn't allow new enrollment under the expansion with enhanced federal funding after December 31st, 2019. After that point, if expansion enrollees have a break in coverage of more than 1 month, they won't be able to re-enroll unless a state wanted to cover the additional cost itself. Both bills would cap the amount of federal funding that states can receive per Medicaid enrollee starting in fiscal year 2020. The ACA provides premium tax credits to those who buy their own insurance on the individual market and earn between 100% and 400% of the federal poverty level. The House bill would change that to tax credits based on age, not income, with older Americans getting more. The Senate bill would make tax credits available to those earning up to 350% of the poverty level. For those earning above 150%, the Senate bill would adjust what they pay out of pocket for premiums based on age, with younger individuals paying less as a percentage of income toward premiums. Insurers can charge older Americans five times more than younger individuals under the GOP plans. That ratio is 3-1 under the ACA. And those are just some of the provisions in the Republican health care bills. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Vaccinations are considered one of the great public health achievements of the 20th century, reducing fatalities from most common and fatal diseases by up to 99%. But as recently as 2009, only 45% of the nation's preschool-age children had received all of their recommended vaccinations and boosters. And researchers at the Children's Outcome Research Program at Children's Hospital in Colorado decided to take an in-depth look at the problem.
Primary care practitioners are so overstretched. There are so many competing demands that it's rather impractical. And they also require a level of technical expertise that sometimes they don't have.
Dr. Allison Kemp heads up the Children's Outcome Research Program, and she conducted a study on what would help to generate better compliance with the required vaccinations. And she found that when parents received timely reminders from their state and local health departments, parents were much more likely to get the vaccinations and boosters for their children that they needed, more than if they simply relied on a reminder from their primary care provider.
What our study did was to centralize those efforts. So it didn't take away from the primary care providers, but it helped them to do the reminder recall for their practices centrally using a state registry. So this was much more efficient and much more cost efficient.
Dr. Kemp says her research shows that when a reminder message can be generated for an entire population across communities, it takes the onus and the burden off of the primary care and pediatric practices. Her study, published in the December issue of the American Journal of Public Health, showed that those effects were pretty significant.
In a fairly short 6-month period in the counties where this was done centrally, about 19% of children who were not up to date became up to date, versus about 13% in the practice-based recall state. So, you know, about 6 percentage points higher, which on a population level within 6 months is really very powerful.
Dr. Kemp's work suggests that a regional or state immunization information system, like the one in her home state of Colorado, could provide the most efficient means of outreach. And the study also suggests that there's a cost savings with a centralized state or county-run database and reminder system, both in terms of the vaccines themselves and in reduced medical costs as fewer children fall ill.
I can tell you that there have been some studies in recent years showing outbreaks related to a lack of immunization or delayed immunization, particularly pertussis, measles, and even H influenza, Haemophilus influenza. And, you know, you have one case of influenza, Haemophilus meningitis, can cost tens of thousands of dollars. The costs are era of not preventing these illnesses are very high.
A state health department-driven vaccination program that assists private practices in vaccine compliance for their patient population, improving vaccination rates of young and vulnerable children while improving the public health? Now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.